This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio and streaming Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about a brand new show that's coming up on Prairie Public's television service called More Than Just the Music. We're going to talk with the principals in this documentary. And first of all, Darcy Reese, you're the vocal choir director for the schools in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Barb Gravel, the Prairie Public production manager and the producer of More Than Just the Music. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
How did this production come to be?
Well, we will start back in April of 2018 when our education services manager, Tim Wollenzine, visited with Darcy. She had an idea for a documentary about her choir and her program and said to Tim, can Prairie Public get involved with this? And he said, you better call Bob Dambach and Barb Gravel. And so she did. And we traveled to Thief River Falls in May of 2018 to see the big spring show, which is very impactful. And it touched us. It did. And the thing that I remember about the Lincoln High School Choir program was its mission, which was to educate, inspire, and involve the students of Lincoln High School. And this is a mission that I thought was true and dear to Prairie Public, and I thought this is perfect for us to take on.
Well, More Than Just the Music will air on Prairie Public's television service Thursday, October 31st at 9 Central. And Darcy, give us a little bit of background. You've been in Thief River for quite a while.
34 years. And this is a dream come true for me that we are absolutely so excited about. We've done this work for, I've been doing shows like this on our May shows for the last 20 years. And actually it was 19 last year when we finished the documentary as far as taping. And this is something that I would love to be able to have other viewers that are teachers to see this and witness what it's like to go beyond the music in the classroom. And that's what we do. And this documentary that Barb and her team did of my students and myself and a whole bunch of other people that are extraordinary in it, I can't. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. It tells an awesome story. I'm so excited because I just saw it for the first time at 4 o'clock today, and I am usually not short with my words. I can talk forever.
Right ahead.
But it just took my breath away. It was beautiful.
Well, I've seen it too, and it was much more than I was expecting because it's aptly titled, More Than Just the Music. Mm-hmm. There is a this movement that is part of the decorations in your choir room. Yeah. What does this stand for?
This stands for The Hero Inside Shines. And that's that. Who are the heroes? My students. And the students are the heroes, and they're the ones that take the message that we create together out into their world, and hopefully will use all the information and the lessons that we teach and the lessons that they take away from the half a year project from January to May. And if we perform it in New York City, it goes all the way to June. They're the heroes, and it's an absolutely beautiful journey that I get to take with these awesome high school kids of mine.
Underneath that poster that's this movement, The Hero Inside Shines, it says, we refuse to let the world be as it is. We refuse to blind ourselves by excuses and lies. We are determined to have an effect on this world. We will persevere to change our world, one action, one note at a time. Barb, how long did this documentary take to produce?
It took about a year. We were fortunate enough to be able to travel with the choir down to Minneapolis several times and go to Thief River Falls to capture the rehearsals, the singing rehearsals, the production committee, getting together, the dance rehearsals, the final show. We traveled to Minneapolis to interview musicians and other composers and people who are instrumental, not only in this year's project, but in the projects ever since 2000. Mm-hmm. And what a team Darcy has developed with the connections that she has of ultimate professionals who have the exact same mission and drive and passion to work with these students, and not just musically, but again, this teaching humanity through music is really, really what gets at the heartstrings, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's get a little sample of this. Come Together is the title song from the 2019 concert, the most recent. It was written by Minneapolis composer Darnell Davis, who's worked with the choir for years. So, mm-hmm. Skip, let's get a sample of that. Darcy, you brought in professionals, as Barb mentioned, from the Twin Cities, New York City, yep. Chicago, California, to work with your students. I can tell you, as somebody who's worked in the arts, that is invaluable experience to be around those people. How did you get them there?
Well, it all started with two awesome musicians that I just came across because they came up to Thief River Falls for a workshop. And working with our, actually work with my music theory class 20 years ago. And I asked this awesome woman by the name of Jeannie Brindley Barnett, what is something that you are the most proud of in your life thus far as your music goes? And she said, the butterfly songs. And I said, tell me about this. And she said, well, it's about the Holocaust and it comes from the book I Never Saw Another Butterfly, and she said she got this book and she opened it up and the words just spoke to her, and she started writing music and setting music to some of the poems and the writings from these children that were incarcerated at Terezin concentration camp. And I said, oh my gosh, I need to be a part of that. And I did not know what it was going to look like. She didn't know what it was going to look like. And a year later, we were recording at NPR in Studio M.
Which is a big studio.
Yeah, and we were recording the butterfly songs there, and then we went on and we sang for the National Holocaust Remembrance Day ceremony at Bethel Synagogue in Minneapolis area, and we became very good friends with the Holocaust survivor who has since passed away that opened so many doors for us by the name of Henry Ortelt. And it just moved from there, and then we were in Chicago doing it in some of the synagogues. And then Jeannie and Steve. Steve is a producer. He's a Grammy Award-winning producer, and her husband and this little girl, me, from Greenbush, Minnesota, met all these people, and the doors were just flying open. And the next thing I know that I had people like Kenny Holman. He's with the Hornheads in Minneapolis, and he played for Prince, and he played for Janet Jackson, and they were opening doors up to other musicians that played with Whitney Houston, and they were all coming to Thief River Falls, and it was just crazy. And then they knew somebody that knew somebody else, and then I met Horace Clarence Boyer, and it just moved into the Black African-American history and culture, and it's where I sat because that was my absolute favorite, and I'm just really at home with that music.
So that one show you talked about, the butterfly poem, the Terezin concentration camp in Czechoslovakia, it's not just music. It's a history lesson. It's politics. It's religion, humanities, a lot going on there.
Yep.
So when you were confronted with this intriguing combination of stuff, this stew that you found in Thief River Falls, Barb, how did you put this together? How did you decide how to tell the story?
Well, that was an interesting approach, because not only were we telling about this most recent year's concert and accomplishments, but it's really culmination, a retrospective of since 2000. And so we do have in the documentary VHS video, but it's a treasure to see these concerts, the Butterfly Concert and some of the other Woven Voices, Woven Threads. So through the years, not only can you see Darcy's hair color change and some of her fashion and some of the styles, it's amazing and intriguing, but it's fun to see some of the, over the years, how the changes have become. And I believe, and you can reiterate this, Darcy, is that really there was a lot of cultural and topics that way early on, and then it maybe has segued into more social issues, more topics of the day. And I'm sure some of that you confronted with the population of Thief River Falls, of accepting it or not accepting it. But whatever, you know, people took away was a conversation, and the students were able to have dialogue about these very, very, very important subjects in today's world.
Well, let's talk about that. Lincoln High School has 700-800 kids. A lot of them take choir, it turns out. About 160 of them do. And they are now, I guess, the people who go out in that community and share these discussions.
That's what I hope.
I assume it's happened because you get a lot of community support.
The community in Thief River and just the northern area up there, because I'm originally from, like I said, Greenbush, Minnesota. And their support is, I couldn't do it without their support. Just like you can't do what you do with Prairie Public without your support, I can't do it without their support. And, we touch on, you know, it's basically a very small rural community of white Christian population, and I like to delve into things that these young people are going to experience once they get out of the doors of Lincoln High School, and that is not the norm everywhere. And we talk about those things in an environment where the kids trust each other and trust me, and then we're able to dialogue. I have a thing on the outside of my door that says courageous conversations take place here, and we're known for taking courageous conversations. And we also understand that we get messy sometimes in our conversations. We don't always agree, but we need to always respect. We need to respect everybody's thoughts and ways and cultures and religions and gender and identity. And these are the things that we talk about. And I think they should be talked about in every school in America.
When I saw the rough cut of more than just the music, I was impressed by a little piece of the video that I saw where there's this big choir up there. And there was one African-American girl.
Christina.
And eventually, I am seeing all of these African-Americans from Chicago and the Twin Cities. You mentioned Horace Clarence Boyer. Getting involved in bringing that culture and that music tradition, and I mean a gospel and the whole deal, happening with your choir.
And I didn't, I mean, I've always loved gospel music. I was brought up on white gospel music, right? And then all these awesome artists from Minneapolis, Robert Robinson, he's a mentor of mine. Darnell Davis and the Remnant, they're mentors of mine. Tanya Hughes from Minneapolis, another mentor of mine. They showed me how to sing gospel and how to teach gospel and how to conduct or not conduct gospel. And it just stirred something in my soul that I've this little country farm girl never knew she had. And I'm a better person because of all of these things that we have done together. And, you know, my students, somebody's asked me before, well, who influences you the most? And it's my students. It's my students.
Well, there's a segment in the documentary where you're getting them to move.
Yeah, we move.
And it is wonderful because it really doesn't look like you would expect a choir to look like.
No, we don't.
In Thief River Falls.
No, no.
Barb, this is something that's rather emblematic of the Prairie Public mission. This kind of enterprise that they're doing in Thief River Falls, shown by a documentary that you produced at Prairie Public. This is what we do here.
This is what we do. We love to sing the praises of the people of our region, and it's people just like Darcy and her choir that are doing such special things. And when I met her, I knew this is the perfect person, the perfect topic, because it is representative not only of what we do, but of our educational services, with the students involved, and just all around, Doug, this was something that I knew was going to be a huge success for our department and our organization.
The other thing you'll notice when you see the documentary, More Than Just the Music, which is Thursday at 9 Central on Prairie Public's television service, is that it's not just singing.
No.
It's dance, it's poetry, mm-hmm.
It's all the arts, all generated by the students. And something that you won't know unless I tell you this, the instrumentalists, some of the instrumentalists that are actually playing were my former students. And so to see them take that and come home and still be a part of what we do, that's when I know that it's made an impact on their lives as well.
Well, tell us how the choir is selected, because a lot of these kids are with you for years.
Yeah, for the last 10 years now, I've also been the middle school choir director. And so last year, I just graduated students that had been with me for 7 years. And there's no auditions until you get to the end of your 10th grade year, and then you audition to be in concert choir your junior, senior year. And that is the group that travels and takes the show out of Thief River Falls on tour years, which is every other year, which is this year.
Where are you going this year, and where have you been?
We're going to Carnegie Hall this year.
Wow.
And we have a half an hour that we get to put our show there. We have been at Alice Tully Hall at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where we brought our whole entire show. Our whole entire show is 2 hours without any breaks. And we bring the whole show to Alice Tully Hall, and New York people that I go through, they generate an awesome audience for us there. We've also done our entire show at Jazz at Lincoln Center in the Allen Room, and we've taken bits and pieces of it to St. John the Divine in Harlem, and like I said, in various synagogues in Minneapolis and in Chicago, and just numerous churches in the metro area. Yeah.
So, you played some big halls.
Yeah. The bigger, the better.
And you are currently in a kind of a collaboration with Patrick Henry High School?
Yeah, that was the culminating factor last year in our show, Breaking Barriers, Building a Foundation of Humanity. We teamed up with Cortland Pickens in North Minneapolis, and we worked with his students, who are primarily all students of color, and with my students, all primarily white students from a rural community. And we worked together and put our music. We traveled down to Minneapolis 3 times and worked with them. Barb was with us 2x. And then they came to Thief River, and we put it all together with all the instrumentalists and put on a 2-hour show and wonderful memories and everything that goes along with it.
Well, it's time for another musical sample
right
here. So let's listen to Audacity of Hope. Darcy, where was that recorded?
Well, that was recorded in a little tiny recording studio called Skywalker Ranch in Nicasio, California, which is also on the property of George Lucas Studios.
So what's it like to take a little group from Thief River Falls to Skywalker Ranch and cut a CD?
It was absolutely phenomenal. No words for that. That took us 2 years to plan, to be able to raise the amount of money that we needed to go out there. And again, Steve Barnett, the gentleman that is the Grammy Award-winning producer, he's got ties out there. And he said, Darcy, you want to do a CD? And I said, yeah. Where do we want to go? And he goes, let's go to Skywalker. And I went, wow, okay, let's do this. And we did, and we have a full-blown CD from Skywalker called Audacity of Hope.
And I think, you probably can buy that somewhere.
Oh, yes, you can buy it. You can buy it by getting a hold of me. It's also on iTunes, Spotify. It's all out there. Just click in Audacity of Hope, and it'll come up.
Now, you've been at Thief River Falls for 34 years.
Yeah.
This choir has been going great guns now for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what's happened with some of these students.
Oh.
I mean, they've gone on to other things, right?
Yeah. I have a lot of choir directors out there. I have a lot of students that are in professional players that were also in our band and orchestra program, but I had the pleasure of working with them as well. A lot of students that are out there working in music ministry, you know, just taking the music out and doing their thing with it. The choir directors I'm especially proud of because they're taking our message and taking it into their choirs.
And if you want to, you know, own this wonderful story,
oh,
you
yeah.
can go to shopprairiepublic.org and get that video online or as a DVD, I assume, $29.95. Worth the price, believe me. Barb, let's talk a bit about the business of putting something together after you've gone on the road. You've spent a year gathering all kinds of video. You can be, you know, just dizzy looking at all of this stuff, listening to all of it, trying to make sense out of it. The post-production process.
Yes, that is a very different process than capturing the video, but it's equally as fun in the sense that we get to reflect back on all of the interviews, all of the video that we have recorded throughout the year, and put a story together. We had over 15, I believe, interviews to sift through, to pick out the sound bites, the relevant topics, and I have to congratulate my staff and thank them. Because without Anhal Anderson and Andy Garski and Megan Vettelson and Kelly Johnson, they were instrumental in videotaping and editing and doing so much of the work on this. So just like any project, and Darcy, you can attest with your choir, this is a very much a team effort.
Yes.
So I'm just representing my amazing team, and I thank them so much.
Well, let's close by talking a bit about the arts mm-hmm. in education. There's been a lot of emphasis on science, technology, engineering, mathematics, that kind of stuff, which are very important skills, no question about that. But the arts offer something, too.
The arts also offers a lot of those things within the arts. It brings that side of the brain out in music, too, because it's a foreign language. You know, I always say this to the teachers that I work with who are awesome at Lincoln High School, that the kids will get those things because they have to have those things to graduate. And they will build on them if it's something that is really near and dear to their heart. But we need to also feed their souls. The arts feed the soul. You need to have something that you can go to, that you know that you can relax with and that you can feel human again with. And that's the other part that I believe my students are leaving with healthy mindsets and healthy visions of their future.
And it's like a team sport, highly collaborative.
Yes.
You really have to work together.
Yeah, I mean, we have a production committee that I sit down with that are my students, no other adults. I'm the only adult that works with the kids other than the instrumentalist. And we sit down and we say, what are some of the issues that we want to talk about this year? And first we start talking about these issues in the class. And then we start thinking about what songs or what readings, who's going to write the reading that's going to go along with mental health issues, or who's going to write the reading that's going to go on with acceptance, and we put all those things together, and I can't do it by myself. I'm a teacher, and I want to teach kids how to have a vision and see the vision come to fruition at the end, and that's where I get all the joy in teaching.
All right. Well, Darcy Reese, thank you for being with us on Main Street today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Barb Gravel, always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Yes, always glad to be here.
And I want to thank our audience here. It's the board meeting and Friends of Prairie Public gathering at the Radisson Cityscape Ballroom in downtown Fargo. Thank you all for being with us as well. That conversation took place last week at a Prairie Public gathering. More Than Just the Music airs tomorrow night at 9 Central on our television service, and it will also be available tomorrow on the Prairie Public YouTube channel. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear from the author of a book about Indian boarding schools, and an Army Corps of Engineers spokesman will talk about our rivers and reservoirs. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. It's never happened before. People will not be allowed on the Jamestown and Pipestown reservoirs this winter for snowmobiling or other recreational activity once the ice forms. Stutzman County Sheriff Chad Kaiser says it comes down to safety.
We're being told, obviously, we're into some high water that we haven't seen before at this time. So we're going into ice up into high water, which means they're going to have to release higher releases through the winter that we haven't done before in this area. Either reservoir has not. This is unprecedented territory that we're in.
Kaiser says the ice will be very dangerous throughout the winter. Barricades will be placed at all public access sites. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says the agricultural community is facing the perfect storm of really bad things. Walz made those comments during a tour of northwestern Minnesota on Tuesday. The trip allowed the governor the chance to meet with producers in East Grand Forks.
We're up exploring things, if it makes sense for us to change rules on moving propane, to talk about when property taxes are due, to give some relief there to folks, to let them know the state cares about this, and we can't allow folks to go under.
Walz says he's hearing words like unprecedented when it comes to the challenges facing growers. He says while things like the weather are something we can't control, there are ways to help.
But it's frustrating to me, things we can control, like trade deals. We need to get those things done. That doesn't do much good for those folks whose crops are stuck in the field. That's where we need to make sure those safety nets are there.
North Dakota has made a request for a secretarial declaration to provide relief to farm country. Walz says a similar request could be made by Minnesota. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has established the U.S. Domestic Hemp Production Program. The 2018 Farm Bill legalized hemp, and now USDA has established rules for it. John Mortensen is the hemp coordinator for the North Dakota Ag Department.
The big things that I've seen so far in reading it is USDA is laying out a testing protocol and a sampling protocol, which will be nice to have a national protocol so we don't have so much of, you know, one state's doing one thing, the next state's doing the next. I mean, it's going to be a level playing field for our producers and other producers in the country.
Mortensen says some things will not change.
So there's a background check fee, which will not be going away. The new farm bill still requires background checks for growers, which are good for, I think, 5 years. And then on top of that, then there is a license fee based on your acreage, and that fee won't exceed $350.
Right now, North Dakota has 64 licensed hemp growers. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. November is Native American Heritage Month, a time to celebrate cultures and traditions, and a time to remember some difficult history. In years past, policies of forced assimilation led to decades of indigenous young people being sent away during the Indian boarding school era. NDSU Assistant Professor Denise Lajmadeer teaches education leadership and is the author of the book Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and the Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. Lajmadeer will speak about her book at Minot State University on Monday. Here's an excerpt of a conversation in June with our Ashley Thornburg about the boarding school experience.
Students were taken from their homes and sent there to be completely whitewashed. There was forced Christianization and, of course, forced education, turning us into white people. Students were taken away from their families, their homes, their tribe, their culture, their language. The language was literally beaten out of them. And then outing program to send them summers to work in white homes, again, to learn to be as white as they could be. Kill everything in them that was indigenous or native.
Mm-hmm. This was children as young as 5.
I've seen them as young as 2 and 3 in my research.
2 and 3.
That were literally stolen from their homes.
And put on trains, put on buses, shipped who knows how far away from anybody that they ever knew. And just even the first story alone, and you use the pseudonym Josephine in this story, she talks about being 5 years old and being beaten at school, forced labor, rampant sexual abuse. She's not able to use the words, but she says that at 5 years old, she was asked to bring wine to the priests and woke up with problems down there.
Yeah, yeah. She was being molested, so she figures that they got her drunk. And then she started having problems in her female area. It wasn't the nuns that would bring her to the doctor. It was that priest. So it was just a way of keeping it secret and not known.
How did you first learn about this history?
My interest in boarding schools began with my parents. My father was boarding schooled. He was stolen in 1925 from the Turtle Mountain Reservation and sent 3 days and three nights on a train to Chemawa, Oregon, where he was there until 1929. When he was around 77 years old, just before he passed away, I started recording his war stories when he was in World War II, and he would say Army was a piece of cake compared to boarding school. So I interviewed him, and then I also had a chance briefly to talk to my mom before she passed away in 1977. She was only 47 years old. She was also sent to boarding school. So their parents, my grandparents, were all also sent to boarding school. And then my great-grandparents, that was the era of buffalo hunts and then being put on reservations. My uncle, who's 95 years old, I visit with him this summer, and he said that my great-grandma was kind of mean, and she would carry a pugamagon, which is like a big stick. And I asked him, why was she mean, Uncle? And he said, well, he was quiet for a while, and then he said, well, she saw the Indian Wars. So it was not that long ago. I remember her. That's that intergenerational trauma and that historical trauma.
Yeah, we have this understanding that if your parents smoke, you're more likely to smoke. That if your parents were abusive, you're more likely to be abusive. We are barely scratching the surface on this concept of intergenerational trauma or historical trauma that actually is changing humans on a cellular level to survive the kind of abuse that was rampant to the indigenous people of this land.
If someone studied my blood, they would see that trauma within my blood just from my family, much less extrapolate that to, you know, millions of Native people that are boarding school survivors here in the U.S.
When you first heard about historical trauma and what that is, you describe it like getting punched in the gut.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
It was when I first heard the term adult children of alcoholic.
Mm.
That was, I sat there and said, adult, I'm an adult, I'm a child of an alcoholic. My goodness, that's me. My father became a violent alcoholic. And now I understand more about what shaped his life, the boarding school, the trauma at boarding school. Then he went from there to CCC camps, and then he went to World War II up in the Aleutians. So he's probably in PTSD all of his life, mm-hmm. or what in that time we called shell shock. So he dealt with that by becoming alcoholic. So that term was like a punch in the gut. And then I started going to meetings and so on to understand more about, you know, being raised as a child of an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
So then intergenerational trauma, historical trauma, again, it was like, that's me. That describes me and my family. It just helped understand why we were raised the way we were and what happened to us. And
mm-hmm.
Papa would, he was beaten with the belt, and, you know, Mama, too, was made to kneel on a broomstick handle. She went to Stevan boarding schools. They punished us the way they were punished. So we were hit with the belt, and then we had to kneel in the corner. They also were never hugged or loved in boarding schools. And so we were never hugged or told that we were loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that intergenerational trauma that's passed down.
Mm-hmm.
So then when my two kids got to a certain age, I found I couldn't hug them or tell them I love them. And I never could figure out why. And I would go into therapy, but the therapists were white and they didn't know anything about boarding schools. Doing my research, I started seeing mostly from Canadian history that because they did not learn parenting skills in boarding schools, they couldn't pass it on to us.
Mm-hmm.
So as a parent, I'm trying to break that with my kids and with my grandkids, break that cycle and hug them and love them up, and no matter how old they are and so
yeah.
on. So trying to break that cycle now that I'm aware of it.
Yeah, not taught parenting skills and instead taught violent behavior. You have a story in the book, and again, it's called Stringing Rosaries, The History, the Unforgivable, and the Healing of the Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. We're visiting with author and educator Dr. Denise Lajmadeer, and you're talking about learning violence and these kids that are taught to use violence. There's a story in the book of a child being held down on a bed and beaten with belts by other children at the boarding school. And if a child showed mercy and hit that other child lightly, then they had to swap places.
Yes.
So you're teaching them, show no mercy.
Yeah, that's my father's story. It's called the gauntlet. It was very common throughout the boarding schools. Students or even the teachers would line up on either side, and you'd have to either crawl through or run through as you got hit by belts or sticks by other kids. And if you let up, then you'd have to take their place. Papa said that he still had scars from that. He was in infirmary for 2 weeks. The infirmary was on the school grounds, so there was no other doctors or nurses that could ask why, what happened, or report them like there is, you know, now in place. Mm-hmm. You file a 960.
And there are infirmaries at the school. There are also cemeteries, mass graves, sometimes unmarked. They didn't even bother to learn the kids' names.
Yes. Chimawa, where my father was, has over 220 graves. A gal named Marcia Small, she took a ground-penetrating radar, and there are graves on top of graves or there are unmarked graves there. So I go there a lot to Chimawa and walk the cemetery and pray and offer tobacco and prayers for the for the babies that are buried there that never got to go home. And I look at the 13 or so that were buried when my dad was a student there, the 5 years that he was there. And he was a carpentry student, and I often wonder, I never had a chance to ask him, but he probably had to make the caskets for those students. Or there was one student that died. His kidneys were ruptured. He was from Browning. He was Blackfeet. So was dad one of the students in the line that had to hit that student? Did he feel he was responsible for killing that student? That's something I think about, I worry about now.
How did you get people to open up about this?
I put something in the newspapers about that I wanted to start telling stories and start interviewing about their boarding school experiences, either good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And people called me and would tell me, I've got stories that would stand your hair on end, or I want you to tell the world my story. So when I would go to their home, I would travel through Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. But I wanted to go where they were comfortable. So if they wanted to interview in their office or in their home or even in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. So I'd give tobacco. I would bring gifts to give them, because when you ask someone for something, you always give something back. Bring water, bring food to them. And then I would also tell them that my parents went to boarding school. And being Native, I think I had more of a foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently listened to some interviews that were done in 1970 by a non-Native interviewers and some students from UND. I was a little frustrated, like they didn't know what they were asking or even what to ask. So I think I had a bit of an in and a comfort level with them when I could tell them my dad's experiences, our mamas, our my grandfathers that were also beaten at Fort Taunton, you know, with the rubber hose. And he passed out from being beaten. He had stolen a can of tomatoes because it was like a sweet fruit to the boys. They were always hungry. Everybody in this book was hungry. Everyone
was
hungry.
There's a lot of starvation.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you even keep moving forward on this? This book took you more than 12 years to put together. I imagine a lot of that is just, I don't know, crying?
Once I get into my car, I would break down often in tears, and it would take a while before I could drive back to the university or drive back to my home here in North Dakota. I do an hour and a half long presentation on this boarding school history, and I would practice it in my office for a year, and I would constantly break down. So I would not go out and do this until I could go through all of this without breaking down, without crying. The last few times I notice that I start tearing up, and then I know that I what I do is put it away, because I don't want to break down and cry in front of an audience or non-Native students at a college and so on. So I just have to toughen up. But at one time I put the book away for 4 years, almost 4 years. I just couldn't do it. I was too close. I was too emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I even stopped interviewing for a while. Once one of the gentlemen I interviewed in the book, he became suicidal after I interviewed him, and he called me back, and because he had never told anybody that he had been sexually molested at the boarding school. He had never told anyone except for me. I was able to call the tribal mental health and get him in there within 45 minutes. He was seeing a therapist and a counselor. Mm-hmm. So that scared me. So now I will only interview if you are in a program of sobriety or therapy or have access to that.
Are you able to incorporate some of your traditional healing methods, whether it's dance or working with birch bark or poetry?
Yeah, all of those help a lot, being a dancer, a jingle dress dancer, and my poetry is my therapy. But I also have our traditional tribal ceremonies, such as our rain dance, our sweat lodge, and there's other ceremonies that our moon ceremony, our woman's moon ceremony, offers a wipe away the tears ceremony, or I'm doctored through the rain dance to continue this work, because I'm not going to put it away. I'm going to keep interviewing, even though this book is done. There's still people that are saying, you should interview so-and-so, or someone will call me and ask to be interviewed. So I will continue. It's not about me. These people I've interviewed have said, tell the world what happened to us.
That was Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Dr. Denise Lajmadeer, author of the book Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and the Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. She will be speaking at Minot State University in the Student Conference Center on Monday at 2 p.m. Next on Main Street, an update on the wet conditions affecting our rivers from a spokesperson for the Army Corps of Engineers.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home, creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Matt Nelson. He's chief of the Water Control and Water Quality Section for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Omaha District. He joins us from Omaha. Thanks for being with us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the current condition of the river basins you monitor in the Omaha District where we live up here in North Dakota?
Sure. North Dakota has been extremely wet, really, since the end of September through really current days. The rivers are very full, and as well as the ground surrounding the rivers. A lot of water across the state of North Dakota.
And earlier this year, in the early spring, as a matter of fact, there was some devastating flooding south of us, South Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, and those areas are still wet, aren't they?
They are, yeah. It takes a long time for all this water in the system to work its way south, eventually to the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, there was a Bismarck meeting last week regarding releases to lower water behind Garrison Dam and also discussion about releases that would continue throughout the winter. Can you give us a sense of how this all works upstream, downstream, all these dams holding water and the concern about soil moisture and winter precipitation and all that kind of stuff? What do you have to do to get the dams ready and the reservoirs?
Sure. Well, when it comes to the operation of the reservoirs on the main stem of the Missouri River, that's actually handled by our division office. So I don't have a direct hand in regulating those reservoirs. But generally, the system works where we try to make sure the reservoirs are, you know, lower heading into winter so that when the snow falls and it melts and comes off in the spring, we have plenty of space to store that runoff and to get it out safely over the winter and fall months.
Well, I saw an indication, a story earlier this week that right now the levels, the reservoir levels behind Garrison and Fort Peck and Owyhee in South Dakota are 6 to 7.5 feet above normal reservoir levels. That's a lot of acre feet of water.
That's definitely a lot of water. But again, you know, I don't have a direct hand in regulating those reservoirs.
But how much risk is there for serious flooding? And I understand that we have to wait for winter precip and, of course, the spring thaw and the rains and all that. But setting up it for the fall with the kind of soil conditions that we have and the reservoir levels that we have, how would you rate our risk?
Sure. It would definitely be higher than in past years. Right now, the ground is so wet that any rainfall that were to occur wouldn't really absorb into the ground very well. because there's already water there, and it would go straight to the reservoirs and cause, you know, a much bigger response than normal. And then when we're heading into the winter months, what that means is that all that water in the ground will freeze there. So come spring runoff season, a lot of that water, again, will run off and head to the rivers rather than absorbing into the soil. So we're at a higher risk. It won't take as much snow to potentially fill up the reservoirs this year.
Now, you were in Jamestown last night, and Jamestown and Valley City in the central and eastern part of the state have been dealing with some high water from their rivers. How would you describe the circumstances right now?
Particularly in the James River Basin, they've gotten just hammered with rainfall after rainfall after rainfall, and then a blizzard on top of that a few weeks ago. Comparing to normal levels, they've seen something north of 500% of normal rainfall, which at this time of year is really, really uncommon. And so it's caused the level in the river to rise, and also a significant portion of the flood control space in the reservoirs to fill as well. So we're working to try and get that water out before winter so that we have plenty of space going into next spring.
And when you do move the water out, if there's ice on the reservoir, and there inevitably will be, that removal of water can create voids under the ice. I hadn't even thought about that, but that can be potentially hazardous, can it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big message we're trying to get out this year, is that the conditions on, you know, ice conditions on reservoirs and on the rivers are never safe. But this year they will be particularly unsafe because the water will be moving so much, and that ice will be moving with the water as the reservoir levels drop and as the river levels change downstream. So it'll be particularly unstable and particularly dangerous for anybody to get out there.
So be careful around reservoirs always, but particularly this winter, I take it.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else about the current state of the rivers and the reservoir system in North Dakota that needs to be shared with our listeners?
Just that, you know, we understand that the river levels are high and conditions are not ideal, but we are working round the clock to make sure we are operating the reservoirs safely and to make sure that we can set ourselves up as well as we can heading into this winter.
But at this point, to the Missouri River Basin, the entire stem of the river through the central U.S. appears to be particularly vulnerable?
Yes. There's just a lot of water that'll still be moving through heading into the winter months. And with as wet of the soil that we have, increased chances for above normal runoff.
All right. Well, thank you for spending a little time with us today. Matt Nelson is the chief of the Water Control and Water Quality Section for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the Omaha District. Appreciate your time, Matt.
All right, thanks.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Emily Colzer with the Clay County Historical and Cultural Society about women's suffrage, the 100th anniversary, and we'll have a story on mating rituals of prairie chickens. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available now at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 30th. The United Commercial Travelers is a nonprofit fraternal benefit society that touts services and products for its clientele, while giving back to the local communities. It was formed in Columbus, Ohio, as a society to provide accident insurance and other benefits for traveling salesmen and their families. The organization spread throughout the United States and Canada, but today, Grand Forks has the only local chapter in North Dakota. Previously, Fargo and Bismarck both had active chapters. I.W. Cunningham, who was the national organizer of the Loyal Order of the Moose, was quoted in the newspaper as saying, "I am a UCT because I believe in progress. The United Commercial Travelers is one of the most progressive fraternities on Earth today." If it had not announced its intention of going a step beyond any other social, fraternal, or commercial order, I would not be a member of it. The organization was non-religious, and the chapters hosted a multitude of events. One event, hosted by the Bismarck chapter around the end of October, was the annual Halloween dance. On this date in 1926, the Bismarck Tribune noted that the UCT Halloween dance had been a success, attended by 200 guests, saying, "Elaborate decorations, suitable to the Halloween season, formed the setting for the annual fall ball of the UCT, which was given last evening in the dining room of the Grand Pacific Hotel. The room had been bedecked with orange and black streamers, and witches and ghosts stood guard in the corners of the rooms, and black cats, owls, bats, goblins, and other emblems of Halloween were in great profusion. The dance began around 10 p.m., and guests lingered till the early morning hour of 3 a.m. Hungry guests were able to eat a two-course supper at midnight. This meal was served by a group of members wearing high hats in the Halloween colors and aprons of orange and black." Yet another fraternal society, the Masons of Bismarck, also planned to open their social season with a dance. They had planned it for the same night originally, but pushed it back to not conflict with this annual treat, obviously well known and enjoyed in the community. It was a bewitching good time for all attendees. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You'll find more than great scenery on the foot trails of Ireland.
You're standing on the bones of the ancestors when you walk these paths, through the woods, through the mountains, on the coast.
Explore Croatia's Istrian Peninsula.
I would say that we are a rediscovered destination.
And get in touch with the rhythm of the sea.
When the tide is out, the table is set.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
They come from the bowels of hell, a transformed race of walking dead.
So you've seen them in books and movies and on TV. They're really a global phenomenon. But where does the story of zombies really begin?
The zombie within Haiti were also part of a secret society.
A history of zombies and our obsession with them. Plus, we'll have the latest on the impeachment battle on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Join us Halloween Day for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
When I was growing up, it was cold by Halloween all the time.
You're up north, too. You're Walhalla.
That's
way up there.
That much farther.
Way up there, near the border.
Is it on the other side of Highway 2? Because that's really Canada. Yeah, totally Canada.
That's coming up on Thursday. And catch all of Sue's conversations on our podcast, Main Street Eats.
Thursday on Main Street, nicotine addiction, tainted cartridges, and concerns about a growing black market have health officials and legislators trying to address issues around vaping. On our show tomorrow, we'll talk about vaping with Fargo CAS Public Health Tobacco Prevention Coordinator Melissa Markegaard. Sue Balcom will join us for a Main Street Eats conversation about Halloween, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.